This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest is the internationally known poet, Ethelbert Miller, who is our featured poet on this, our 40th anniversary on air. And he was the first person on air 40 years ago. So I want him to read an opening poem.
Before hip-hop, there was Nat King Cole, Sugar Ray, and Miles. Cool was how you held a cigarette between fingers, or entered a ring, or simply found your stage and turned your back to the world.
That's our man, E. Ethelbert Miller, and we are celebrating this volume that weighs about, I would say, 5 pounds, The Collected Poems of E. Ethelbert Miller, edited by Kirsten Porter, and it's about 500 pages. I have known every poem in this book, but to get them together is something different. What do you feel when you look through your life, Ethelbert?
Well, when I look at this book, I'm deeply grateful for my friendship with Kirsten Porter. This book would not have been possible without her assistance. She's a woman that I met when she was a young student at Marymount. You know, she's a professor there.
She was an undergrad.
She's undergrad, right.
And now she's a professor.
And now she's a professor. You know, she went to the creative writing program at George Mason. I helped her there when she was in graduate school. So it's a long friendship, you know. I'm close to her mother and father. So I feel that this has been a relationship that has grown. Today, Kirsten is my literary assistant, so we're working together. We joke about how this book has 14 sections, with the 15th section being on her computer, so that every time I write a new poem, she files it away. And so whenever someone asks for a poem, I can ask Kirsten, well, you make the selection because you have all my new poems on your computer. And so that's how I've been much more efficient the last several months.
She's your biographer.
And she has a good sense of what my life is about.
I have to say that this is the most consummate introduction to a book I have ever seen. She goes chapter by chapter. She explicates and she puts the heart into it.
Well, that was one of the things.
It's like a PhD thesis.
Well, one of the things I asked when she agreed to do this, I said to Kirsten, I want a long introduction. I want a long introduction because I felt people knew my literary activity, you know, the work that I supported, the writers that I promoted, but didn't have a full grasp of my work itself. And so I felt no apologies. And so I felt that she did a very good job. Some people say, oh, this is too long. I said, well,
no,
this is my collective work.
I read it again last night, and it is really interesting reading. I mean, it's not that dry academic.
Right. Exactly. It's very personal.
It is personal because, well, she's known you for 10 years.
Right.
Yeah. Ethelbert Miller is here. We're at the Library of Congress, and he's going to give us a handful and a heartful of poems.
What does the E stand for? Everything. Each I exists, embracing exceptional emerald evenings. Evolution explains Eden's evil. Earth's ecology equates exploitation, evaporation. Eras ending evergreen elms. Escort elephants, eagles, elks eastward. Enlightenment echoes Ezra, Ezekiel. Enlist Esther, Eugene, Ethan, Edward, Ellington. Enough English, explanation, echo. Exit, eternity, elucidate, Ethelbert, elucidate. E evokes every ecstatic emotion.
E. Let's have another.
Okay.
Just give us a handful,
okay,
honey.
This is a poem for my dear friend who no longer is with us. That is the poet June Jordan, and this is Grand Army Plaza. I would write this poem to June, and June would respond with a poem also entitled Grand Army Plaza that appears in her collection, Passion. Grand Army Plaza for June. Here, near the entrance to the subway, the underground, we stand in each other's eyes, once lovers, now friends. We have walked the 5 or 6 blocks from your house to here, where the night is not dark, where the light from the street shines on the small wet spot on the head of your dog, who pulls slightly on the leash you hold here with one hand, and it is the other that I think about shaking before I leave, now that we are friends, and women love women, and men love men, and many of us are alone despite it all, here in Grand Army Plaza. I think of soldiers departing to fight a civil war, to be wounded and to die. I think of a man and a woman, lovers now saying farewell. Here, I take you in my arms, hatless and out of uniform, like an unlisted man, afraid of going south.
Oh, just tell us briefly how you met her, because your history and you're making history.
Well, I met June. I remember, you know, when I was working at Howard University, my mentor, one of my mentors, Stephen Henderson, I remember he was across the hall from my office, and he was eating this little half smoke, and he was reading a one of June's books with one of a poem in there about Mama, that he was saying, "Oh, this is just a fantastic poem. This is a poem that, you know, everything I've been talking about, the Black, I said, it all come together in this one poem." I was like, "Okay, what's great about this poem?" And then, I guess by coincidence, maybe a few months later, Amizu Bolton and I went up to New York to a book party celebrating the work of Henry Dumas. And we got to the book party early, and this woman came up and told us to fix the chairs and put everything in order. And we were really upset because, you know, Amos was happy to be in New York, and we had this big New York City book party, and this woman is telling us to fix the chairs and get everything in order. We found out later it was Toni Morrison, but we didn't know. But everybody started coming into this book party, you know. I remember it was like Angela Davis, you know, Sun Ra, Melvin Van Peebles. Oh. And then I looked across, and there was June Jordan. And I had never met her, you know. And then when the reception, you know, the party was breaking up and people started talking, mingling, and I went up to her because, you know, Henderson had been talking about her. And that's where I extended an invitation about her to maybe to come to Howard.
Yeah. Well, you were aficionados together. Yeah. You were really, you had an epistolary relationship for years. I hope those letters are somewhere.
Oh, yeah, sure. Okay. I mean, all of the letters that June wrote me are at the University of Minnesota.
Well, the reason, you know, I asked Ethelbert about June Jordan is because he's the repository of our culture, and if you ask him about any poet, he will be able to give you this long exegesis about where he met them and what became of them. And he is a writer and a literary activist, author of several collections of poetry. Would there be like 9, maybe?
About 11.
And 11, and 2 memoirs. And he serves as the board chair of the Institute for Policy Studies, which is a progressive think tank in Washington, D.C. And for 14 years, he's been the editor of Poet Lore, which is the oldest poetry magazine in the United States. I think it was
1889.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now he's ours, and we're going to hear him now.
So this is what the living do. When did we begin to wear sneakers to funerals or sports jerseys and caps? When did things begin to die? I pass a church 4 blocks from the Safeway. I see the last generation of old Black men in suits. These men are professionals. They touch death every day. They carry the coffin and drive the hearse. They arrange the flowers and offer comfort. They escort you into limos and tell you where to sit. They know the directions to the cemetery. What do you know? I know that I am dying. Dreams first are what you might call the lint of disappointment. It has always been this way, this knowing, the realization that I will do this alone. I once believed in love the way I believed in beauty, the living with dignity, style, and grace. I thought my shoes always needed to be polished whenever I left the house. There is a way the day ends after you pass a funeral, how you walk down the street afraid to look over your shoulder. They say, this is what the living do.
And just to make sure that no one leaves their radio, go on and give us another.
This is called cell phones. In the days before cell phones, we spent our time looking for loose change. We ran to the phone. We tripped over phone cords or stood on lines waiting to use a phone. We forgot phone numbers. We were listed in phone books. There was no text messaging. In the days before cell phones, there was phone sex, and people slept with their phones. Phones were big and hung on walls. You could cradle a phone and wait for a sweet dial tone. If you were lonely, you could call the operator. There was always someone to assist you. Today, everyone has a cell phone. They spend days and nights talking in strange places. You could be in the middle of reading a poem, and someone's cell phone will ring. In the days before cell phones, you searched frantically in your bag, trying to find something to write with. You wanted to find a pen, not a phone, before the ringing in your head stopped. Mm.
Ethelbert has delivered the commencement address at Emory and Henry College and was awarded an honorary degree of Doctor of Literature. He's been a Fulbright Special Scholar and a Fellow to Israel in 2004 and 2012. He's frequently a commentator on NPR and has his own weekly morning radio show, On the Margin, which airs on WPFW-FM 89.3 every Thursday at 9. You have been a man of the world. You're an authority on sports, politics, jazz, public affairs, international relations. When you look at this book, what do you think you've learned about yourself?
I think when I look at this book, and what I hope this book will be known for, I want this book to be known for is love poems. You know, I think over the years, that's been my strength as a writer. Those are the poems that I feel came out of very personal experiences. Those are the poems that when I look at my influences and the work that I wanted to model myself after, I wanted to be like Neruda. Mm-hmm. I wanted to have those type of poems that people mm-hmm. would go back and quote.
Which they do.
Yeah, and I wanted those poems to be poems that people would go back in terms of those days of despair.
There's a longing in your work, a wish, a yearning, a longing for intimacy, not only with people, but with the world.
Yeah, and that's the thing. When you say that, I mean, that word intimacy, that's something that I've come to learn later. I learned to learn it later in my life, you know. And there are poems in which they're written because of dedicated to a person who's able to make me see that concept, you know. And that's where I'm grateful to the people who come into my life, because one of the blessings of friendship is that you learn different things. And intimacy is something that I'm glad I learned about it at this point in my life, you know.
That is in every poem, though. Ethelbert, even as a young poet, when you were 25, the intimacy was what was everyone responded to, and we would love more of it.
The ear is an organ made for love, mm-hmm. for Mickey. Mm-hmm. It was the language that left us first, the great migration of words. When people spoke, they punched each other in the mouth. There was no vocabulary for love. Mm-hmm. Women became masculine and could no longer give birth to warmth or a simple caress with their lips. Tongues were overweight from profanity and the taste of nastiness. It settled over cities like fog, smothering everything in sight. My ears begged for camouflage and the chance to go to war. Everywhere was the decay of how we sound. Someone said it reminded them of the time Sonny Rollins disappeared. People spread stories of how the ear would never be the same or forgive. It was the end of civilization, and nowhere could one hear the first notes of a love supreme. It was as if John Coltrane had never been born.
That's a great favorite, that poem.
Yeah, this is a poem I dedicated to my friend Mickey, because Mickey was visiting here in D.C., and we were going around. It also is an outgrowth of being downtown after a program, coming out of the National Press Club. I was walking down the street with my wife, and there was a couple behind us, and they were talking, and they were using a lot of profanity. And I remember my wife said, "It sounds like they were punching each other." You know, and so that stood in my head. And then what happens is that, and this is a thing where if we're writers, you know, we have to address this. People don't want to talk about what we can see, how our language has been corrupted. It's been corrupted by gangster rap. It's been corrupted in terms of now. Well, even
you always say that.
Yeah, and you can even take it into the presidential election this year. Hillary Clinton, for example, has an ad in which she has like some young kids that's watching TV, and they have some images of the candidate running on the Republican ticket. And, you know, he's just spouting off
with
stuff that you would mm-hmm. never have heard the President of the United States use. And keep in mind, this is the highest office of the land.
Do you think that ad is effective?
I think those ads are very effective, because when you see those ads, you don't see Hillary Clinton. You see your children. You know, that those ads should play very well in those states that are out in, you know, small town. Because what happens when you look at, you know, the values that people want to hold on to and the values they want to teach their kids, language is very important. I mean, I've never in my life heard my mother use any word of profanity. And my father, you know, because he had an accent, I found out later what those words were. But but what happens is that it was just something that was not allowed. Do you remember when a child would use a word of profanity and somebody would say this? And I know, Greg, you have not heard this expression in a long, 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 long time. I'm going to wash your mouth out with soap.
I know.
Can you imagine saying that to somebody on the metro?
Well, Ethelbert, you came in cherishing language. Mm-hmm. You came in with the wish to uphold it. And that's what you're all about. But since you're making these comments, I do want the audience to know that you have a show on scholarship. And it's called The Scholars on UDC right. TV. Mm-hmm. And you also have a blog which deals with current issues as well as the things we're talking about now. You were inducted into the Washington, D.C. Hall of Fame. And you have the Associated Writing Program George Garrett Award for Service to Literature. But it is your words we love the most.
Excerpts from the Lost Diary of the Black Houdini for Enid Miller, my mother. Mm. 1. What if I told you slavery was nothing but a magic trick gone wrong? Would you believe me? 2. It was during segregation that I decided to hang myself upside down, my feet pointing north and upwards, my head still in the south. 3. There is no prison I cannot escape from. I've known blackness. Mm. 4. When I was a young boy, I was a runaway. I disappeared from the plantation and then history. 5. What is the difference between escape and erasure? How many times have I changed my name? 6. The color line makes us all acrobats. I learned to pass white folks without a net. 7. The crowd applauds after each performance. When they look into their mirrors, they see me. 8. I taught Marcus Garvey the hat trick. Everyone loves a parade. 9. King tells me his dream. I consult my dream book and find a page missing. 10. My father takes me to Coney Island. He tells me all of America is an amusement park. Learn to laugh or die. 11. Fame made me a race leader. I get paid for describing misery, not magic. 12. White teeth and a big smile. I hide the key under my tongue. 13. Let me tell you about metamorphosis. It will explain why I'm there and not here. 14. Love is a pair of handcuffs. Do I want to escape? Can I? 15. My mother died yesterday afternoon. All my life I've been trying to reach her. 16. I hold my breath and keep counting. How long can I survive underwater without love? You know, in this poem, I became very fascinated by Houdini, who here in D.C., you know, there's that famous picture of him hanging downtown upside down. And I took some of those ideas and wove it into my own life. Because there was a point where I thought of Houdini as this magician, but Houdini's primarily an escape artist. And so I try to use that metaphor throughout the poem. And then Houdini had a very, you know, close, interesting relationship with his mother. And so you see me bringing that back in section 15 of this poem. My mother died yesterday afternoon. All my life, I've been trying to reach her.
Beautiful.
And that was a thing where, you know, he was always dealing with the occult, trying to find a way of communicating with his mother who had died. And then the poem was extremely political, like 9. King tells me his dream. I consult my dream book and find a page missing. I think that was very interesting. And then even today.
I have to say that you have humor and tears.
Right.
Humor and tears in every line.
And then this one, this is very timely. Number 11, fame made me a race leader. I get paid for describing misery, not magic. You know, and I tell people, you know, it's like right now, this is July. There's probably a whole bunch of people who have these books that are going to be about Obama or the Obama administration. They're just waiting to write the last chapter. But they're going to make money, you know, from these books. So for right now, we want to have these dialogues on race. And, you know, I've been very critical of that because I think the key thing now is that people don't listen, you know, that if you would just put people in a room, so like Quaker style, listen and hold hands, are probably much more successful.
I wouldn't mind if they brought your book in too.
Well, you know what happened? If you look at, And this is a thing I've talked about and written about, the whole thing in terms of, you know, you get on a bus or something like that and a white person doesn't want to sit next to you or whatever, okay? And you realize that many people have not had that sort of intimate relationship. You know, I remember when Diana Ross kissed Ed Sullivan on TV, or when Petula Clark touched Harry Belafonte. I mean, those were national. You talk about dialogue on race. Just bring back Petula Clark touching Harry Belafonte.
Have you written about that?
No, I'm just saying it on your show. You got the exclusive. If you go back and Petula Clark touching Harry Belafonte, Ed Sullivan's response to being kissed on TV by
Radio
Diana Ross.
Waves go on forever, but I still want you to put this on paper.
Okay. That's my homework assignment.
That is terrific. Say one word to us about minimalism, the slightness, because you've been taught as the poet of simplicity and humility, as Lucille Clifton did, because they say, I didn't have time to write a long piece. Have you ever heard of that one? So tell us about
I started out writing very short poems. The influences very early were Norman Jordan, his book Destination Ashes, that I think Third World Press put out. Even Hakeem Madhubuti Donnelly at that time wrote short poems, okay? I remember my first reading at All Souls Church. I could probably read all my poems in about 10 minutes and sit down. And I probably feel that I started writing longer poems because I started doing poetry readings, okay? But most of my work was short. I think over the last few years, I've gone back to that because I'm not really doing a lot of readings. And so I enjoy the short poems. This is why in this book, you know, you'll find
haiku. You have everything.
Yeah. You know, what happens is various different forms and structure that I use. But what happens, I always was trying to say less, you know, more with less.
The extended metaphor is what you've championed, where you can take one idea and turn it around to mean five different things. And that's what you do. That's what you're the champion of.
And I think somebody would probably look at that from 2004 to now. I think that my writing definitely has changed from blogging.
When you say 2004, why?
That's when I started my e-notes. That's when I started my blog, you know. I mean, many people, there was a point where people identify me as a blogger, and my blog was linked to a lot of other sites. And this is when, especially for the African American community, I was like a person who was blogging very early, but I never wanted that to be my defining, you know, identity. Like, I'm a blogger, you know. Even like right now, with so much spoken word and open mic stuff going on, I tell myself I'm a shirt and tie poet and I'm a literary activist, you know.
Before we go into the next poem, just what is an activist?
Well, a literary activist for me, you know, and I take pride in perhaps like coining the term. I've seen a couple of people use it. But for me, it's an outgrowth of one, me being a writer and publishing. That's very key. The second component of it is promotion. I've been promoting writers, whether I'm editing Poet Laureate magazine or doing my Ascension series. I always was promoting. Many times as service to the field, I try to be generous with my time in terms of doing blurbs and introductions for people's books, sort of encouraging careers. That's key. But the most important part of the literary activist is preservation. You know, I'm very much concerned about preserving literary history. I'm very much concerned about the interpretation. You know, for example, now, you know, we've been collecting things, but now we still have to make sure that a generation of scholars and critics begin to come in and use this material to make sense. You know, one of the things about the GW archives, you know, going back, that's an outgrowth of, you know, me going over to GW, Howard Gillette, and Rod French, who used to invite me over to GW, and Gillette was, and I made a reference about the archives, and Howard Gillette said, wow, can you flesh that out? And so I went back, and I drafted like maybe a three-page proposal, and one of the people who I shared that proposal with was Chasen Gabor. And Chasen Gabor became very excited about it. And
that was a long time ago.
Chasen Gabor made the first contribution.
You were his executor.
Right.
He
turned over his copyright.
He was one of the first people we knew who died at AIDS.
Exactly.
In 84.
And what happens is that that's where I began to see the importance of, you know, being a literary activist, to keep individuals' names alive, especially whether it's Chasen Gabor, whether it's Essex Hemphill. I was just looking at the number of people that I met through Amazu Bolton. You know, and that included people like Mae Miller, Dolores Kendrick, Wanda Coleman, Brenda Marie Osby, a whole list of people.
You couldn't name them all if you stayed
right,
here for
right.
3 days and two nights.
Right.
But we do want some closing poems.
Okay. This is called Angela. I was too young to do the Lord's work, so they left me by the side of the road. and went walking off into the sunset. The shade of the car and the heat from my own breath stuck on my tongue like the words from the good book. They had a calling. First my mama, then my daddy. Someone called out their name, telling them that there were things to be done and this was a time for miracles to be believed. My daddy took the rifle from the basement, and I watched him bless it at the dinner table, telling my mama that this here should be the tool that they should give thanks for. I was 5 years old and could not reach the butter or the bread. And my mama asked my dad if this was the right thing to do. I still remember the silent look he gave her. And Jeff down the road gets that look every time he sees a stray dog. So I know it's best for my mama to say amen if she don't want an argument and to simply trust in the Lord. And in my daddy's house, the Lord wears blue underwear and watches TV. And I asked my mama to pass the bread. And daddy, he put the gun down in the chair next to me like it was my brother or sister. And it sat next to me while I ate. And all the time I kept asking myself why and when. We're going to go on a trip to the mountains and give ourselves to the Lord, my daddy finally say. He belched it out like he finished his food, but his plate still had meat and gravy on it. We're going to go to the mountains and give ourselves to the Lord this evening. The world don't need us here no more. He asked my mama to fetch the Bibles. And I said, I'll help since we have Bibles everywhere. Where other folks have clothes and furniture, we have Bibles, hundreds of them. And my mama always tells me to trust in the good book, and I wonder which one. But this evening it don't matter, because I'm scared, and I don't know what I believe in. And when my daddy says he's ready to kill himself, let's go. I fall down on my knees and start crying. I can't pray to the Lord, because the Lord done bless my daddy, and besides, I'm just a child, and who would listen to me? And that's when my daddy says to my mama, maybe she ain't ready to do the Lord's work. What you think? And my mama looked at me like she was standing over me in the bathtub, studying me close, looking for some spot of dirt that I missed. And she paused and said softly, maybe she ain't ready. No, I don't think she's ready yet. Which is why they left me here, by the side of the road, by the car with a box of Bibles. And I watched my daddy lead my mama towards the mountain, one hand on her shoulder and the other on his gun. And I don't know how far they got before they disappeared, because I was crying like a lost sheep, or maybe a stray dog, one that Jeff could find. I prayed for Jeff to find me, because I believe the Lord already knew where I was.
Ethelbert, before we close, you have to read my favorite poem, Divine Love.
Okay. This is Divine Love, and this is dedicated to Alex and Sue Jin. I wish I had loved you many years ago. I would have loved you like Ellington loved jazz and Bearden loved scissors. I would have loved you like Langston loved Harlem and the blues loved Muddy Waters. I would have loved you like Douglas loved to read and Garvey loved parades. I would have loved you like Zora loved stories and Du Bois loved suits. I would have loved you like Lewis loved boxing and Mahalia loved to sing. I would have loved you like Carver loved peanuts and Wheatley loved poems. I would have loved you like Jimmy loved Lorraine and Ozzy loved Ruby. I would have loved you like Martin loved Jesus and Malcolm loved Allah.
And we love you more than that.
Oh, you're amazing, Grace.
This is the voice of Ethelbert Miller you've been hearing. The name of the program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Our funders are the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry and the Reva and David Logan Foundation, and friend of poetry, Hiram LaRue. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.